Good morning. The congregation recently engaged in a strategic planning process that resulted in the adoption of three goals and corresponding objectives. Okay. So, in case you don't see them, I'll tell you about them anyway. Our third goal is to live out our commitment to justice, equity, and compassion. And the objectives are basically for us to understand our role in perpetuating racism and that anti-racism is a spiritual practice. Understand how privilege impacts our community. Develop strategies to be more welcoming and inclusive. And to assess the organizational impact of this work. Today's special sermon, the rededication of our Black Lives banner, and the forum following this service have been designed specifically as a way to launch our congregational efforts towards achieving this goal. Through today's activities, we hope to also engage your hearts and minds in recommitment of our efforts to dismantle racism. My name is Marian Randall, and I'm a member of the 8th Principal Action Team, along with Karen Gunderson, Meg Gunderson, and Claudia Desmangles. I'm sure you're wondering, what is the 8th principle, and what is the 8th principle action team? What is she talking about? Many of us think of the core Unitarian Universalism as the 7 principles which are listed in the inside of the gray hymnal. Well, some you use have proposed an actual 8th principle. And it reads, we, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. That 8th principle came from a feeling that we needed to do something to renew our commitment to this work, to hold ourselves accountable, and to fulfill the potential of our existing principles, the 7 of which I just spoke. We felt that this proposed 8th principle merged perfectly with our strategic plan goal and provides a broader denominational dimension to our congregational work. We will, like many other congregations across the denomination, have more discussions about the proposed principle, which will eventually be voted on by delegates at a future UUA General Assembly. As a little aside, for those of you who don't know, the UUA is a Unitarian Universalist Association, which is the overarching organization that each independent congregation, such as ourselves, belong to. Each year, it holds a General Assembly, which we always refer to as GA, where it's always in June, and thousands of UUs come together from across the country to do the business of the denomination and to learn to worship together. And it's really a lot of fun, by the way, so I recommend you go. Because of this great synergy between our UUSS strategic plan and the proposed new principle, the team working on our third goal of our plan decided to dub itself the 8th Principle Action Team. Ta-da! Our role is to develop the structure, what actions do we take, and to coordinate, how will it happen, a congregational-wide approach to implementing the objectives associated with this third goal over a period of time. Today is the launch of this important work. It's really important to know that there's no clear roadmap or formula to use when seeking to dismantle racism. This is not a linear process. What's most important is that we stay engaged and continue to build the skills that enable us to respectfully and thoughtfully work through hard conversations and revealing introspection. In an effort to keep our spirits and minds seeking to dismantle racism, some of our future plans and activities include, and it starts today and is followed by the February 29th event with the Reverend Abhi Janamanchi, which is listed in your blue sheet. There will also be a multicultural day yet to be arranged, which includes a congregational assessment. We will have other discussions specifically about the proposed eighth principle. A speaker series and book groups and movie nights along with facilitated discussions. So those are some of the things on the list. So now Karen will come up and give you a few words about our forum that follows today's service, and we really hope that you will stay and participate in that.
Good morning. I just wanted to tell you a bit about the forum today and encourage each of you to get some soup and come back into the sanctuary, because that's where it's going to be. It'll be a 40-minute video. The video is of the Ware Lecture, which is a really big event at General Assembly that Mary mentioned happens in June. This was the Ware Lecture in 2018. So the Ware Lecture really is a big deal. Martin Luther King was once Ware lecturer, Shirley Chisholm, Kurt Vonnegut. I mean, so it's typically people who inspire and challenge. And so this video that we're going to see is of Brittany Packnett. And Ms. Packnett is an unapologetic educator, activist, writer, and national leader in social justice. She is currently a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Public Policy and was on President Obama's task force on 21st century policing. So in short, she's a badass. So the film will be followed by 30 minutes of tabletop discussion, small groups facilitated, similar to the processes used in the spiritual deepening circles. I've watched the video twice so far, and I will tell you it is definitely worth your time and attention. So join us after the service, grab some lunch again. And as we start this journey together on our third goal, we ask that that you move forward with us with an open heart, spirit of curiosity, and willingness to hang in there even when the work gets difficult. So thank you, and please be sure to stay after the service.
Dan and I have four amazing, wonderful adult daughters. Maida and Claire are birth children. They are white. Ali and Alaza, our adopted children, are black. Raising kids is hard. Raising teenagers is really hard. In the heat of angry moments, any of the four might yell, "I hate you. You are so unfair. You don't understand." And sometimes Ali or Laza would say, "You're racist." Then I would laugh and say, "You can call me lots of things, but you can't call me racist. I adopted black kids." I thought I was doing the right things, finding black salons to do their hair, learning about black skincare, buying them black dolls, and decorating for Christmas with black angels. But at the same time, I wanted them to conform to what society expected so that they would be successful and happy. And this was racist, because these societal norms were created by the dominant culture, which was white. What I was telling them subtly, if you act whiter, things will be easier, that being black was a disadvantage. It pains me to say that out loud, and I cringe when I think of how I dismiss their feelings. I know I hurt my daughters, who I love very much. I wish at that time I had taken the time to ask, "Why do you think I'm being racist?" and then really listened to what they were trying to tell me. When they became teenagers, I saw firsthand how my white daughters were treated differently than my black daughters, by teachers, by store clerks, by the police. I also saw how adults in charge would change how they were treating Aaliyah and Alaza when Dan and I showed up, because we were white. I've watched Aaliyah and Alaza navigate a world where the color of their skin caused people to assume and prejudge. There is one good thing about how we raised them. We did demonstrate a model of how to be heard and get respect in today's society. And I saw that because when Alaza's daughter was born 15 weeks early, I watched her use all the tools I had given her to talk to the doctors and hospital staff, being assertive and respectful so she could get the information she needed. I then watched her boyfriend, who is black and was not raised by middle-class white parents, try to interact with those same doctors and staff and not get the same results. He was louder and more abrupt, and to my white ears, he sounded angry. And I wondered, is that how the doctors viewed him, as angry and possibly threatening, instead of a young father who was scared about his daughter? If he had been white, would he have been less threatening? This is what everyday racism and racial bias looks like. We all need to acknowledge that these thoughts and feelings exist in each of us, or we can never change. If I had a magic wand that could create racial justice, I would use it to help people take the time to be more aware of their ideas about what is right, the right way to express yourself, the right way to protest, the right way to be successful in the world. And then they would need to acknowledge mine and our biases, asking where those ideas came from, and are they true? To take the time to be genuinely curious about other people, to ask questions, and then to really listen. This would be a world where differences aren't seen as disadvantages, but what makes each of us unique and beautiful. I don't have that magic wand, but I do have a voice that I can and will use. My grandchildren, both white and black, deserve this world, a world of love.
I'd like to speak to you this morning a little bit about the history and culture of our faith tradition. The Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed is a black minister who has served UU congregations in Rochester, New York, and Toronto, Ontario, alongside his wife and co-minister, Donna Morrison Reed. Mark is a lifelong UU. He grew up in Chicago in the 1950s and 60s with his family attending First Unitarian, a Gothic-style white stone church near the University of Chicago campus. Mark's father worked as a scientist in the Chicago area. His dad's coworker and laboratory partner told him about the Unitarian faith and invited the family to visit. They started attending and they joined. I remember when Mark's voice cracked as he told a group of us how, from that simple invitation from a friend, his family's life was changed. Knowing Mark as a beloved senior colleague, I feel grateful that our UU movement has been enriched by his ministry and scholarship. He's written one book about the history of our denomination in civil rights campaigns and several books about the experiences of African American Unitarian Universalists, their joys, their achievements, and their wounds. He writes about the missed opportunities in our history when either our denomination or congregations were not able or willing to welcome, listen to, and include people of color. For 200 years on both our Universalist and Unitarian sides, and then in our consolidated UU faith, the attitudes, habits, and patterns of behavior in our structures and in ourselves too often have given the message that black lives don't really matter. For example, in 1860, just before the Civil War, William Jackson, a black Baptist minister, spoke to a convention of American Unitarian ministers in Massachusetts. He testified to them that he had been converted to Unitarianism. He wanted to spread its good news to other blacks. He asked for assistance and guidance. Instead, the Unitarians took a collection and sent him on his way, according to one historian. Quote, "No discussion, no welcome, no expression of praise and satisfaction was uttered that the Unitarian gospel had reached black people." In 1911, Joseph Fletcher Jerdon, a black Universalist minister, was running a school for black children in Suffolk, Virginia. Jerdon wanted to start a seminary, too, so blacks could enter the ministry. His vision was for those ministers to spread the loving message of universalism throughout the South. He requested $6,000 for a seminary. The denomination turned him down. He did raise a few thousand dollars from Sunday school offerings at individual Universalist churches in the Northeast, but it was not enough. To put this in its context, 30 years earlier, the denomination had started a mission to Japan to take Universalism to Japan, and it was still funding it at $6,000 a year. Morrison Reed adds, between 1918 and 1921, American Universalists gave $75,000 to aid Armenian war victims, as well as supporting the mission in Japan. He asks, why was helping those far away more compelling than reaching out to those nearby? What does it tell us? Black lives don't matter. End of quote. When the topic of racism and inclusion in our UU movement has made us uncomfortable, some of us have resorted to the defense that our predominantly white religion has never appealed to people of color. Morrison Reed says that's false. Universalist and Unitarian historians barely mentioned African Americans in our history until a few years ago. Morrison Reed is one who has. He has documented many congregations from the 1940s, 50s, and beyond who had black members and black elected lay leaders. Indeed, he points out that African Americans had been founding members of Universalist, Unitarian, and Unitarian Universalist congregations as early as 1785, when a freed slave by the name of Gloucester Dalton was a founding member of John Murray's Universalist congregation in Massachusetts. Other church founders of color include Amy Scott in Philadelphia in 1801, Lewis Latimer, a founder in Flushing, New York, in 1907. James Cunningham, the first president of the UU Fellowship in Sitka, Alaska, in 1955. And Sylvia Lyons Render, a founding member of the congregation in Durham, North Carolina, and its first board secretary in 1966. The systemic racism of our movement has kept the contributions of people of color nearly invisible. For example, in 1964, the UUA published a hymnal for congregations. Though that was right in the middle of the civil rights movement, our new hymnal had no contributions from people of color, no songs or prayers reflecting their experience or perspectives. It wasn't until 30 years later, when a new hymnal came out, the Gray Hymnal. It does include writings and music from people of color and from cultures from around the world. Morrison Reed has researched religious education curricula from our heritage, Sunday school materials. With a few exceptions, he saw no profiles of the lives of African Americans. This began to change only in the 1980s. In 1986, I was 25, and a volunteer Sunday school teacher in my UU church. For two or three Sundays, we taught a lesson about Harriet Tubman, the woman who fled slavery and went back to the South to lead other slaves to freedom. I hadn't realized that having a Sunday school lesson about historic people of color was a new thing, but apparently it was. As a movement, we're now more inclusive than we were before, but there is more work to do. It will call for courage and humility. Some of us who are white may feel awkward and self-conscious about the work of racism, of anti-racism, of dismantling racism. We may wish for a foolproof plan, a recipe of how to get from oppression to liberation without confusion. There is no plan, no certainty to be had. We may want people of color to explain things to us, affirm our good intentions, and make us feel better. But that is not fair. We can be ready to listen, but we must assume responsibility for our own learning. For white people, the work is ours to do. Morrison Reed says, "Cultural change takes time. Meanwhile, many people of color have been wounded, are wounded, and will continue to be. But change is inevitable and seems to be accelerating." Noting signs of sustained progress, he says, "There is a critical mass. The shift to become a more culturally inclusive faith will continue." Culture is resilient and slow to change. In this country and in this faith, white people often don't see our attitudes, habits, and patterns of behavior as a culture because it is the dominant one. For example, Morrison Reed cites a denominational study of Unitarian Universalist preferences in worship services that was done in the late 1980s. The aspect of Sunday morning services that was most important for 75% of Unitarian Universalists overall, UUs in general, the aspect was intellectual stimulation. It's notable that this term is in our statement of values here at UUSS. In contrast, he says, for African American UUs who responded to that survey, the most important aspect of Sunday worship was celebrating common values. This was the top choice of 69% of Black UUs. Next in order for Black UUs were the categories of hope, vision, and music, all listed before intellectual stimulation. Fortunately, celebrating our common values and seeking to live by them is also how we define ourselves at UUSS. The values of love and courage, openness and curiosity, compassion and support. May we summon the courage to learn, including the courage to learn from our mistakes. May we move into the future not with certainty, but with humility, courage, and love. Amen.
Let's take a deep breath together. I'm part of several ministers groups on Facebook, Worship Collaborative and several other smaller groups, and then the larger UU ministers group. But there's one particular group I'm in where it's white women discussing our challenge in dealing with racism and how we want to work with our congregations and support our congregations. And so the conversation on that group for the past month has been about what to do on Martin Luther King Sunday. Typically, UUs do a lovely service, sing some spirituals, have a thought-provoking sermon, and then that's it, check, right? We've taken care of our anti-racism for the year. So there have been some voices that said, don't do it if you're not taking it seriously. Don't do it if you're not going to carry through with this work. So I'm particularly proud today of our 8-principal action team and the launching of this new effort. And I feel comfortable and positive about taking the time on this Sunday to think about the work that we need to do as a congregation. One of the challenging things for me has been some of the words that have been used in this group of women that I'm with, and they brought me this wonderful little thing. You know Clippy, the word guy who helps you with your grammar? Well, here, Clippy's saying, "Hi, it looks like you've quoted Martin Luther King Jr. out of context instead of engaging with the complex reality of white supremacy in America. Would you like some help with that?" Wow. I love the lightness and the humor of that very difficult word, white supremacy. White supremacy. I am not comfortable with that term. I am not comfortable saying that term. I am not comfortable with the fact that it is an accurate description of the situation in our country. It's an accurate statement of the power and privilege that white people have in the United States of America. The words make me wince. But I'm learning to tolerate them. Tolerance is something that I'm developing, the muscle that I'm developing. I remember on my own journey, my own journey towards wholeness, my own journey towards being awareness of my privilege, I used to think that tolerance was a very low bar. Can't we do better than tolerance? My God, can't we move farther than tolerance? Well, and as I progressed on my journey, I've come to realize that tolerance is not too low a bar at all. In fact, tolerance may have some of its own ability to help us with this process, not just because racism has reared its ugly head or revealed to us what has been present all along, but tolerance is important to me because of my realization of my role in perpetuating racism and my recognition that 400 years of slavery and oppression of people of color in this country, and we haven't made much progress at all. Maybe tolerance is a good place to start. The Southern Poverty Law Center, I imagine many of you are contributors to that organization that works hard on anti-racism, anti-hate, supporting people in poverty. Their curriculum, their anti-racism curriculum for schools is called Teaching Tolerance. Their website acknowledges that tolerance is a challenging word. It says, "Tolerance is surely an imperfect term, yet the English language offers no single word that embraces the broad range of skills we need to live together peacefully." The broad range of skills. So I want to talk to you a little bit today about tolerance and what that can mean, what that's meant for me, and what it could mean for you. Now, actually, we should be pretty good at tolerance because we've been tolerating racism and injustice and poverty. We've learned how to tolerate it. But I want to talk about tolerance of sort of the internal stuff that happens, tolerance so that you can engage more deeply in this work. It's about tolerating our own emotions and our own reactions, sort of like teaching tolerance to ourselves about ourselves. Tolerance is a muscle that we need to develop. So what are we teaching ourselves to tolerate? Our own discomfort. When we are confronted with a perspective or a worldview or an idea different from our own, learning to tolerate our reaction to shutting that down, to have judgments about it. In one of our book groups that we had last year, I gave people an exercise. It was a white group of people, and I gave them an exercise that for the following 2 weeks, every time they mentioned the name of a friend who was white, they needed to refer to them as their white friend. Yeah, that's exactly what they did. Oh, that's so hard. Of course, we do that, my Asian friend, my black friend. White people do that. So I challenged them to every time they named a friend to say, my white friend Joyce is going to have lunch with me next week. Learning to tolerate their discomfort so that they can, when someone makes a racist comment in their presence, they're able to speak up. Learning to tolerate your discomfort. Learning to tolerate not being in charge. Letting other voices speak. Making room. Learning to tolerate and shut down those thoughts and say, well, they should do it like this. I know the best way to do this. And as we engage in this important racial justice work, we must tolerate our own ignorance because we will make mistakes. Don't feel guilty about it. Don't feel bad about yourself. Just tolerate it. I made a mistake. Love yourself. Offer a recognition to the person, but don't give them your pain and guilt. That's asking the person that you have hurt to take care of you. Tolerance is a muscle, stopping our normal patterns. As we learn to tolerate things, we stop. We take a pause. We stop the flow of the negative thoughts and judgments. And that opens us up to hearing things that might be different, hearing things that challenge us or disrupt us. A simple example in my life is rap music. My reaction is, how about, that's not something that I'm familiar with. I'm going to listen. I'm going to tolerate my discomfort with something that's unfamiliar to me. But I'm going to open my ears and I'm going to open my heart to this message that is so important to so many people. We need to learn to tolerate conflict and strong emotion. I remember when the Black Lives Matter group in Sacramento blocked the freeway. Oh my God, how are you going to create change by doing that? This is the work. We need to honor the leaders of these movements. Maybe it's time for us to allow stronger voices to speak their truth and step aside or walk alongside and support this change, learning to tolerate conflict and strong emotion. Learning to tolerate your own strong emotions when you read difficult stories or see movies. Tolerating uncertainty. Working on racial justice is a journey that some of us will not see the end of in our lifetime. It took us 400 years to get to this place. But it's a journey that is started now with more strength than I've seen in my lifetime. Voices are rising up who've been suppressed, and there actually seems to be space in our white supremacy culture to allow those voices to be heard. I have learned so much in the past few years, and I thought I knew a lot. I was an administrator at the University of California, and I had to do a lot of diversity training. I was proud of my awareness, proud of what I understood about this journey. And yet there was so much I didn't understand about white privilege and white supremacy culture, so much I didn't understand. I've learned to tolerate the pain of the lessons of people, of how people of color have been oppressed in our country. It makes me sad and confused and angry, and I've learned to tolerate that as well. I have made mistakes, and I've been embarrassed, and I will continue to make mistakes as I do this work. Whenever I feel discomfort or pain or difficulty, I think it's nothing compared to the pain and discomfort and difficulty of a person of color navigating in a world of white supremacy. But I'm learning tolerance. I'm developing my muscles because I know I can't go back. I can't go back to denial. As a person of privilege, as a white person of privilege, I know that I have to take responsibility for my role in perpetuating white supremacy culture, and I need to use the power that I have to make a difference. Many of you want to have a more diverse congregation, and you've come to me in your open-hearted, caring, concerned way about how do we invite more people of color into our congregation. Well, we have work to do. We need to learn our history. We need to understand how we benefit from white privilege, clarify our role in white supremacy culture. Hearing our history from Roger is one step in that. We need to practice tolerance, tolerance of our own discomfort, our own challenges. This is how we can truly become welcoming. Truly become welcoming and not asking people of color to check their difference at the door. Today is a new beginning for our congregation in our journey to wholeness, our journey to dealing with this challenge of racism, a new beginning that starts in our hearts and minds. We are all in this together, all of us. If we believe in the seventh principle of interdependence, then we truly know that our freedom as individuals and as a country is bound up with everyone else. And we know that we have work to do. Let's go forth on this journey together with love and determination. Blessed be.